Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Allen Sibley, author and illustrator of a series of field guides to nature that bear his name. And we're talking about his new book. It's very different. What it's like to be a bird. What birds are doing and why, from flying to nesting, eating to singing. David, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Hi, Mark. Thanks. It's good to be on.
Now, this is your most fun book, and I want to tell the audience, I mean that in the best sort of way. I just read the book cover to cover. Now, when you're doing a field guide, you don't read a field guide cover to cover. But you could actually read this book cover to cover. As a matter of fact, you should.
Well, thanks. That is really very gratifying to hear. That's kind of what I was going for in the book, or it is definitely what I was going for.
Well, do you get tired of doing field guides all the time?
I mean, they're
important, but they're like a hammer, you know, it's a tool. This is a book.
Yeah, I love doing field guides. My artwork has always been, or the big impetus for me to do my art is information. It's at its core, it's scientific illustration. So my passion is really for gathering and conveying information, and field guides are the perfect vehicle for that. So I don't really get tired of that, but it was a lot of fun to do something different. And this is still information packed, but it was in a much, much more interesting or much freer format.
Well, it's also the emphasis in this book is on behavior, whereas the emphasis on field guides is on visual identification. So this affects your artwork too, because the artwork throughout the book is birds doing things.
Yeah, and that was a lot of fun to paint, a challenge to figure out what to illustrate for each page and to illustrate concepts like fear or optimal foraging. How do you do an illustration that shows
So wait, that? Let me understand this. So you started with the idea first, and then you had to come up with the illustration.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so the way it had a long sort of complicated evolution process.
Well, you write in the book that originally somebody wanted you to do like a simplified identification guide.
Yeah, I wanted to do a kid's book, and the first idea was to just take the field guide and simplify it to make a kid's guide to familiar birds. It was never that exciting to me, and I wanted to add more information about what birds are doing to answer some of the questions that kids and lots of people have about birds. And as I started researching those questions, that what I was learning, and I learned a tremendous amount, it was so fascinating that eventually became the whole book. It's not about identification at all, except in the sense that it illustrates all the most familiar species. But I came up with the questions that I was going to answer, the ideas, the concepts I wanted to present, and then had to figure out which species to match those with, and then how to illustrate each paragraph, each concept. So it was a challenge there. kind of really fitting a puzzle together and figuring out all these different aspects.
This is a large format book too, which is nice. Did you paint things to size?
Yeah, I painted at double the size that the illustrations appear in the book. I always like the way, I mean, my illustration style is loose, almost a little floppy sort of. And I think it looks a lot better when it's reduced. It looks like I took a lot more care and precision with it when it's reduced. So,
yeah, but there's those inner pages of the crows flocking in the tree, which is sort of impressionistic.
Yeah, and that was interesting. I mean, that's the designer's choice. I love it. But I would never have picked that illustration.
Oh man, I thought that was excellent that you went out in sort of that way, sort of really almost abstract.
Yeah, I love it. And the designers picked that out of all the illustrations in the book. So that one is actually enlarged from the original. And that's why it looks even more kind of impressionistic, floppy, sort of like they just sort of splashed across the page. And all the other illustrations in the book are reduced. One of my goals, it's an idea from the very early planning stages of a kid's book. I wanted to give people a real sense of the birds themselves.
Right.
And to illustrate the bird's life size. So the big portraits on the left-hand page of each spread are roughly life size.
Some of them seem even larger than life size.
I think there's some, I say roughly life size. It was so hard to figure out, to kind of calculate. If I'm painting at double life size, and the birds are in all kinds of odd poses and angles and foreshortened and... So I think I got close to life size, but I'm sure there's some that are a little too big, and maybe some that are too small. But it's roughly life size, and so that meant I was, just to keep the math simple, I was doing the original paintings at double life size. So I'd make a bunch of measurements and look up measurements and. Figure out how big to make that original painting and then reduce it 50% to appear in the book.
What I like about it is it does feature your artwork as artwork because of the nature of the way that the chapters are illustrated. So you really get to enjoy your work. Again, when you do a field guide, I'm glad you're doing the artwork that you're doing because that's helping me identify a bird. But in this book, I'm actually enjoying your artwork.
Thanks. Yeah, being focused on field guide illustration for so long, it's very comfortable to me.
Yep.
And, but through all of that work, I got to know the birds well enough and just get enough experience. You paint something thousands of times. And I felt comfortable doing this, and I switched to acrylic paint for these paintings. So the field guides are all done. The bird guides are done with gouache, which
right.
is opaque watercolor.
Right.
And my style is almost like colored pencil. I use a pretty dry. I'll do a couple of light washes of color. And then start adding layers of cross-hatching of different colors to build up the subtle textures and colors. And gouache works really well for that. But for this book, I wanted the kind of bigger, bolder, bright colors and bold patterns. And I started using acrylic paint when I did the tree guide. It worked better for painting leaves because the greens are better and the sort of silky texture of leaves is easier to capture in acrylic. So I got familiar with acrylic painting and it wouldn't be right for a bird field guide, but for a book like this, it was really, really fun to work with, to put on much bolder colors and a much looser style. So I'm not constrained by feather details as much.
But are you eager to get back to gouache?
Actually, no.
So this changed your mind?
It's been a while since I did. I do every month or two, I do a gouache painting for one reason or another. I'm doing commissions or doing other smaller projects or touching up some work. So I've done some gouache painting, but it feels it feels so tight and sort of cramped after doing these big, you know, 15 by 20 inch acrylic paintings that I've been doing for this book.
This is really interesting.
So yeah, I will continue doing gouache paintings, but it's not my first choice. If I were to sit down to do a painting, I would not pick up the gouache.
Nice. Now, the other thing that's really different about this book is that, as I mentioned before, this is a book that focuses on behavior. And one of the things that you write in the book, and I found this really fascinating, is one of the major points in this book is that a bird's life is far richer, more complex, and more thoughtful than you imagined. And to me, this sort of dovetails into what seems to be a sea change in ethology, where before behaviorism ruled the roost for the longest period of time, and now things are really starting to change about how we look at animal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah. I think I get the sense that that is really changing in the new generation of scientists and ornithologists, that there's a lot more focus on behavior as a decision-making process.
Right.
Not a strictly instinct.
And even the idea of what an instinct is changing.
Yeah, and that's, I made that point in my introduction in this book, that I've had this thought for a long time that instinct is a set of instructions, but the animal has to be motivated to follow those instructions.
Right.
And what would that motivation be? It has to be a sense of pleasure or satisfaction or accomplishment at doing the thing that the instinct is urging them to do, or the opposite. A sense of fear or anxiety or dissatisfaction at not being able to do something that they feel like they should do. And that's, it's so, I've come to think of a lot of things that I do as driven by instinct, mowing the lawn, keeping the edges of the lawn neat and tidy, fixing up a nursery for a new baby. It feels like the right thing to do, and you get a lot of satisfaction out of it. And that satisfaction, I imagine, is a universal sort of feeling, that a bird building a nest, gathering food for its young, storing food for the winter, or migrating, all those things, they're driven by instinct, but the thing that makes the bird do it has to be some feeling, some reward.
Way back when I was in college, back in the late 60s and early 70s, when I took ethology classes, talking about an animal in such a way, and was like, it was sort of whipped out of us, that mm-hmm. you're being anthropomorphic. But it's so interesting how many biologists I've interviewed within the last, say, 5-6 years are talking exactly this way. And in some way, it seems like a tremendous relief, or a sense of course that's the way. That yeah. makes sense to me as a person who observes this.
Yeah, and so many things, one study really stood out to me in this way, that sparrows, they find that if you play recordings of a Cooper's hawk near some sparrows, they will get the idea that there's a predator around, that it's not safe to go out in the open and forage. So they'll wait until the last possible minutes of daylight to go stock up on food.
Huh.
And that the part of it is that they keep their body weight low during the day, so they don't load up with a lot of food and slow themselves down, but also they're not going out in the open and exposing themselves to predation. But that one study just struck me, and that I illustrated and talked about that in the book, that one study really struck me as an example of some really complex decision making. That the birds, they're hungry. They need food. They know where the food is, but they're assessing the risk of predators and how exposed they are when they go for the food and what time of day it is, how much food they need. All those things play into it. And probably if a storm is coming, their desire for food would be a little higher. They might risk the predator a little earlier. But that's the kind of decision-making that's going on all the time, these sort of cost-benefit risk analysis decisions. It's not just, I'm hungry, I need food. There's all kinds of other factors that play into it.
Let's talk a little bit about the organization of the book, because it's pretty interesting. Because the first section, there's an introduction, of course, but you have sort of an outline of all the major topics, and then references to each chapter that delves into that. So there's a huge written section, which is essentially the outline of the book, or the things to pay attention to, and then you have your paintings of the different species. And I found that really interesting because I ended up poring over that sort of section of the major topics and then looking up, and I thought that really worked. I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, good. Yeah, that, as I said, the book was really tricky to put together. And along the way, I realized that the way I had it set up was, you know, each species is featured, or each group of related species, and they're more or less in taxonomic order. So it begins with geese, and along the way, there's nuthatches, juncos, all the familiar birds. Each one gets a two-page spread, so a portrait on the left-hand page, and then usually three short essays. But the essays could be on anything. Sometimes they're specifically about that bird, but other times it's about sleep or respiration or migration or predator avoidance, all kinds of, you know, all these topics. And, you know, vision, smell, there's five or six different paragraphs about vision, and they're scattered through the whole book in different places. So I realized early on that I have some cross references in those essays. So like see page, whatever, for more on this aspect. But I realized that it needed some kind of overview, and came up with the idea of essentially that introduction that you mentioned is like an annotated table of contents or index, where each topic is introduced with a sentence, and they're organized more logically than they are in the rest of the book.
But and that makes total sense, and I'm so glad you did that, because otherwise I think, you know, if I want to know more about migration, I'm always fascinated by migration. There's a section on migration, but it refers to many different chapters.
Yeah, so that little, the few essays, or multiple essays about migration, I know there's one in rose-breasted grosbeak and white-crowned sparrow and snow goose and probably some others I can't remember. But yeah, those, I realized that those, it would be so scattered in the book that to read more about one topic, I needed some compilation like that. And that was definitely a challenge to put that together as well. And I didn't,
yeah, but it was worth it because it worked.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. I didn't really intend it. I didn't imagine that people would just sit down and read that section. But several people have told me that they do, that it's just bullet points, kind of a long list of bullet points. But I thought it would just be a quick reference to different the essays related to each topic.
Oh no, it works perfectly. But let's give the audience. We're going to run out of time. Let's give the audience an example. Let's talk about migration, for instance. One of the first points is that not all birds migrate, mm-hmm. And a lot of people may not realize that there are birds. And even if you see birds that you see during the summer in your backyard in the winter, they may not be the same birds.
Yeah, and that was one of the interesting things about working on this book. I knew I was writing it for non-birders as well as birders. I had the audience that I had in mind was the people, my friends and neighbors, who are not birders but always ask me questions about birds. And they ask questions like, do all birds migrate, or why do birds migrate? So those are, a birder just takes that for granted, and you don't really think about those questions.
But I have to say also, a lot of birders don't know the finer down details of migration. And again, one of the important things you talk about, migration is flexible. We were talking about birds making choices. Mm-hmm. Birds aren't locked into doing migration one way.
Very flexible, and different species have different strategies. And some species, the insectivores, the species that live on insects, really have to migrate, and they have to go a long way, and they have to get out of the far north before all the insects disappear. So they're on a more strict schedule and really more predictable, more rigid in their schedule. But species like geese, they just need grain to eat or grass and roots, and they just wander. They'll move south a little bit when the snow comes, and then if it thaws, they'll move back north and then south again if it freezes.
That's right.
They're much more flexible.
There's something that a lot of people don't know about. That's nomadism. Some species are nomadic. I think the only time I've actually seen nomadic species is in Australia, that I can be sure that I actually saw a nomadic movement of birds. And it was I was in Western Australia, and they suddenly had a big rainstorm. We went out the next morning, and it was filled with birds that normally weren't there. And talk about what nomadism is. This is not migration. This is movements dependent upon conditions, isn't it?
Yeah. And so instead of moving north and south with the seasons and changes in temperature and the sort of seasonal changes in food availability, the nomadic birds would just move more randomly depending on availability of food. And probably the closest thing we have in North America is some of the finches, like pine siskin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And also cedar waxwing. And I mentioned that in the book, that cedar waxwings, the band recoveries where cedar waxwings they're banded, and then the banded bird is recovered somewhere else. There are records of birds moving. I don't remember exactly the examples in the book, but it's something like a bird banded in Ontario and recovered in British Columbia or California, and another one from Saskatchewan recovered in Maine or Louisiana. They don't move north and south. They're eating fruit. They're traveling in flocks in search of berries and fruit to eat, which is very patchy and unpredictable. So they just wander. They do drift north and south with the seasons a bit, but in the wintertime, they just move east, west. It doesn't matter, wherever they think they might find food. And cedar waxwings, they're probably cedar waxwings that have gone coast to coast from Atlantic to Pacific or vice versa.
We're going to run out of time, and we can't even get into this book. But there's so many fascinating facts. These are the things like you can bring up at a cocktail party, I guess, if you're at that kind of a cocktail party. But I love stuff like birds lose 10% of their body weight overnight every night.
Yeah.
Then why do they start singing right away instead of finding food?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it doesn't know, that's what they do. They're adapted to lose 10% of their body weight every night.
Wow.
And, yeah, high metabolism and lots of...
Yet they start the day singing. They started singing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, announcing, claiming their territory and announcing their presence is...
They're making a choice.
More important than food in that moment.
Here's one. A single robin can eat 14 feet of earthworms a day. That's like one of those things I've already had to tell people. And it's like, I love the fact that somebody had to figure that out.
Yeah. That's I didn't ground truth that calculation. I read that and thought that was just such a funny way of putting it.
Barn swallows and chimney swifts nest now almost exclusively in human structures.
Yeah.
I find that bizarre because, like, you know, during the Breeding Bird Atlas, the big thing was to try to find a chimney swift not nesting in a building.
Yeah. And
we never did it. We never, ever did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the barn swallows, I looked this up a few years ago. There are only a handful of records in all of North America of barn swallows not nesting in human structures.
That's incredible.
In the last 50-100 years or so, they just don't use anything except barns and houses and
wow.
Yeah.
David, we're all out of time.
All right.
And we've only started talking about this book, and I mean that sincerely to the audience. This book has got so much great information in it. It is a fun book to read, to look at. My guest tonight has been David Allen Sibley, author and illustrator of a series of field guides to nature that bear his name. But we've talked about his new book. It's really good. It's special. What It's Like to Be a Bird. From flying to nesting, eating to singing, what birds are doing and why. David, it's been a real pleasure, and best of luck with this book.
Thank you, Mark. Been great to be with you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.